go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, I missed you guys Friday. Sorry I wasn't here. We didn't get back till late in the evening. It was a very, very long day. But a very pleasant day as well, among other things. We got to see the grandbabies as well as going to the Agnes's doctor appointment. This is The Horn, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Available not merely at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, but across a wide variety of streaming internet radio platforms such as Dar.fm and on your Roku devices and at Streama.com. Also available via TuneIn Radio and their really, really handy app for smartphones, as well as the very handy app for Stitcher Radio, available for iPhone and Android device. You can get the podcast feed at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program, Head On with Bob Kincaid. And you can also find the podcast on iTunes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And wasn't that a lovely couple of hours? Yes, there are some technical things yet to be worked out, but yes, we also will work them out. And I think you will be, this is... Just as with everything else with The Horn, what Dr. Bill O'Brien is doing is mighty special. And frankly, like everything else that's ever come or gone on The Horn, it is radio unlike anything happening anywhere else at all. So that puts us in a realm of considerable... uniqueness. And I hope you will be tuning in Monday through Wednesday of each and every week as Dr. Bill's vision for the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution takes off. And it is a detailed and fully visualized, envisioned plan that I see as being vitally necessary to combat the disinformation, misinformation, and outright lying that goes on in the right wing about what American history is and isn't. So again, I hope you will join us Monday through Wednesday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and as this thing takes off, it may well expand beyond that. It may expand to 3 hours. It may expand to 5 days. It is all going to be largely driven by you. So that, because everything about The Horn has always been listener, audience, Horn family driven. You're not going to find this level of instruction, of information dissemination going on in very many places. If at all, except for here. So we do begin a new broadcast week. I'm being told my levels are somewhat low, and okay, but anyway, like I said, we're beginning a new broadcast week. That finds us looking to raise, of course, $150 this evening, as we do every evening. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The snail mail address is there, too, but for the sake of simplicity, I'll go ahead and repeat it now. The Horn, Head On Communications, Head On Radio Network, whatever. 1038 North Eisenhower, like the president, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, that stands for Personal Mailbox, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801, and for anything going in the mailbox, please don't make checks or money orders payable to me. Make them payable to Head On Communications, The Horn, Head On Radio Network, something like that. Head On Communications, because that way we don't expend a bunch of gasoline going to... It makes Boss Man Wayne's job considerably easier. Because then he, in turn, can just turn it around to the bank and then pay bills. We are a little bit behind for the month of March, so hopefully we can do some catching up. We'll keep our fingers crossed. March is what we do from one month determines whether we are able to do the next month. It is a brutally frustrating way to try to run an operation month to month, but it is how we have evolved. I'm sure that there, and evolution gives you the things you need to survive, not necessarily the things you want or yearn for. So that's the model we have. It is, however, Monday. Thank you, Robert. Sounds okay in Oz. Bob, you sound fine here in Australia, where you're now on at 9 a.m. Woo! Mid-morning! Did you guys switch over to daylight savings? Yes, we did, as a matter of fact. And, can we not... Listen. I know the United Nations has a lot of things going on for it, but can we please just come up with a one world government? Can we please come up with a worldwide standard for who goes on daylight savings time when? Because in all the years that John Fox was doing a show from Australia, the mathematics got really weird at daylight savings time change or back to standard time change. So let's see, we are now 13 hours different from Sydney, but we will be 15 hours different from Sydney, but we'll be 14 hours different at the end of March when they switch over to daylight savings time. Still daylight outside. Kind of getting used to that. And yeah, Marty notes, I hate daylight savings time. Well, I always think of that one thing that I heard back years ago. And it was said to have been an observation by an American Indian who said only a white man would think that by cutting off the end of the blanket and sewing it onto the other end, you get more blanket. Which is daylight savings time in a nutshell. But anyway, no, it's Monday. It's Monday, the 11th of March, 2013. And that means, as much as anything, well, you guys look forward to it all weekend. I do too. Because we get a whole weekend of right-wing weirdos with which to populate, yes... You know what day it is. We get an entire weekend with which to populate more and Monday.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
That's right. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up, step right up. It's Moran Monday on the Horn.
Step right up for less than 5 cents per hour of programming. You, too, can go behind this thin, almost transparent cybernetic veil of canvas, wherein you will see a display, a diorama of morons, right-wing morons, teabagging morons, corporatist morons, fundamentalist morons, morons everywhere, because, in fact, the horn is the program that tells the morons you just can't tell them much. You can't tell the morons without a program. This is that program. No one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in morons. Oh, Lord, yes. No kidding. I don't know if it's because of climate change or what, but we have a bumper crop lately. It seems every Monday we have a bumper crop of morons that spills over into Titanic Tuesday, works its way into prayer meeting Wednesday, pierces the veil of thorn in the side Thursday, and we wind up still talking about them Friday on the front porch. So we may as well get started. Thank you very much, Randy. $30 into what we need to raise, the $150 for the evening. That leaves over only $120 to go. That's 6 at 20, 12 at 10, and all the various and sundry combinations of the same. So thank you. Thank you very much for getting us started, Randy. We're going to be busy. We are going to be busy this evening. That's right, Marty. So many morons, so little time. And I got to tell you, there's a bunch of them. They've been popping on my Facebook page. I've been hearing about it via Twitter, email. But I'm going to start with my own nominee, because this is something you guys weren't necessarily likely to see. I get this because I'm deluged on a daily basis by right-wingers wanting to get their message out. You may recall Thursday we talked about the silliness that was the not really a filibuster of John Brennan, that wasn't really a filibuster, but it was a publicity stunt for Rand Paul that a lot of liberal and progressive groups and individuals got all squishy about. God damn, it was like watching women throw panties at Elvis. So, a little follow-up to that. We understand that a filibuster, as classically understood, is a device whereby one intends to stop something from happening at all via that process in the Senate of the United States. You know, there's no filibuster in the House. So, what it turns out is that far from being the dynamic, shocking, earth-shattering moment of maverickiness on the part of Rand Paul and those squirrels on his head, it was a fundraising dive. It was a fundraising dodge. It was a fundraising hustle. It was a fundraising con that Rand Paul had planned and let all the other Republicans in on, or the ones at least who mattered, to know that he would be standing up and engaging in that little bit of the cheap vaudevillian drama. Melodrama, really. And he did. And then, you know, we had the panty-throwing festival from the progressive so-called left. And, of course, he was confirmed as director of the CIA, as was to be expected, as was never anticipated stopping to begin with. Me? I wouldn't pee on him if his guts were on fire. Brennan. He's a torturer. He's a renderer. And he's a yuck. Just yuck. But anyway, background to all of that, and our Moran Monday nomination. No, I'm not going to nominate all the progressive panty flingers. I'm going to nominate, the right-wing religion industry. pastors denounce Brennan's removal of God from oath of office ceremony. I don't know. Maybe he had God rendered. Maybe he had God waterboarded. This comes in from one of the many right-wing the fundamentalist bunches. And I read this morning and just started giggling uncontrollably. Pennsylvania pastors denounce Brennan's removal of God from the oath of office ceremony. During his swearing-in as the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan swore his oath on an original 1787 draft of the U.S. Constitution. While many are focusing on the fact that the Bill of Rights is not included in what Brennan swore on, perhaps more concerning, perhaps, lovely word perhaps, meaning no it isn't, but we want you to think it is, perhaps more concerning is that Brennan swore only on his own power, you know, his dark Sith Lord powers, that he will protect and defend the Constitution. By removing a holy book from the swearing-in ceremony, one wonders what they would have thought had he been sworn in on, oh, I don't know, Thomas Jefferson's copy of the Quran, perhaps? Brennan failed to invoke God, which is the very definition of an oath. Invoking God is one makes a solemn promise and his power to help in protecting and defending the Constitution or his wrath should Brennan fail in office. His wrath? You mean the wrath that didn't send down a lightning bolt on George Bush or Dick Cheney or Kinda Sleazy Rice or Colin Powell or the comb licker, any of those murderous thugs, those guys that didn't get lightning bolted for getting a wave of murder, cold-blooded murder started 10 years ago? Their wrath, his wrath, that's his with a capital H, by the way, should Brennan fail in office. Blank Blank, to whom I will not give free publicity, a 9-term Pennsylvania congressman and the current president of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network. Oh, dear, we let one of those into the Congress? F me. Is able to clearly and succinctly explain why invocation of a higher power is critical in swearing of a public servant, why this practice is largely misunderstood today, and how readopting it could have the ability to transform America. Really, transform America. No kidding. Morans. Moran Monday really is just a giant radio game of whack-a-mole, isn't it? And transform America. So, right, if we all start wandering around swearing on Bibles, the social safety net's going to get stronger? No, it'll be taken away like Jesus wants it to be. Everybody, every man for himself. Blank Blank's insights are astute, and citizens in beginning to understand the root of the problems we face in America today, which is kind of grammatically dodgy. Is available for interviews about the recent swearing-in of Brennan, as well as the topics of invoking God in public office generally. Invoking God in public office generally. Good morning. I swear, good morning. Upon my honor, good morning. Upon my honor, good morning to you, sir. What a bunch of lunatics. And by the way, just to give this a little bit of visual panache, in this pitch it was underlined that he swore only on his own power. That's all underlined. You know, to impress what? The silly? The gullible? The credulous? The half-witted. He swore on his own power. One wonders. You'd kind of hope that maybe in the 21st century that would be solar power or wind generator. No, it's probably coal-fired. His own power. He failed to invoke God. And it says, and I'll be interested to find this out, that invoking God is the very definition of an oath. Oh, fun. I do love to play with the dictionary. Let's, as the owl said in the old Tootsie Pop commercial, let's find out. Stand by. All right, running over to the Wikipedia. They define it, generally speaking. Is either a statement of fact or a promise calling upon someone or something that the oath maker considers sacred, usually God. Well, maybe they're right. But someone... upon my honor. That's an oath. No God involved. But I'll bet you, if you look at the requirements for the administration of the oath to someone like a director of the Central Intelligence Agency, it will say that that person may either swear or affirm. And affirming is something that you do if you're not a God botherer. So, but just to back up 1 minute on this for this nomination. Notice what they're not concerned about. They're not concerned, these Pennsylvania pastors. They're not concerned about torture, you know, the torturing of other creatures made by the loving God. They're not concerned about rendition. They're not concerned about illegal wiretapping. They're not concerned about a damn thing, except whether or not he promised he made a promise to the sky spook that he'd be good. For heaven's sake. See how it's sneaking into the language? For heaven's sake. Invoking God and his power to help in protecting and defending the Constitution. Well, if we look at some of the things that Mr. Brennan has been a part of in the past, it would seem that the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky has been slacking. Wasn't a lot of help there for people who were... Remember the Uyghurs? Swept up in the general chaos and frenzy to get somebody into the new Guantanamo hotel? Yeah, they weren't guilty of anything related to September 11th, but we just kept them indefinitely in Guantanamo Bay and tortured them a little bit here and there, deprived them of food, played loud music at them, you know, that kind of thing. Uyghurs. Well, our fine Pennsylvania pastors are not concerned about that. Nor was God much help. So there's that. Kevin asking, renderer? Torturer, I understand, Kevin says. But renderer, I can kind of guess from the discussion, but could you give the correct definition? P.S. These Christians are also not very concerned with protecting the Constitution they so loudly proclaim they love. Well, that's true, because I'm sure that most of these pastors are quite certain that we need to get God back into our stews. Do please remember that Pennsylvania consists of Philadelphia in the east, Pittsburgh in the west, and Alabama in the middle. A renderer? That's rendition. That practice, Kevin, whereby we kidnapped human beings, and since we couldn't torture them on our own soil as much as we'd like to, we sent them to places like Syria, where they were kept in boxes and dragged out and tortured real good and put back in the box and then dragged back out of the box and tortured some more. In a game that they eventually just became a matter of, well, I think, fun. We sent him to Egypt, too. Mubarak's Egypt, Assad's Syria. We had a secret, maybe we still have a secret rendition site in what, Poland? Rendering. I find it interesting that the root word is used both in terms of what we have done, and this is Orwellianism at its finest, what we have done to other human beings, i.e. torture, as well as what one does with the leftover fat from a hog killing. Because to render pig fat is to melt it and then reshape it into blocks of lard. Rendering. This is a rendering country now. We render human beings. Nice, huh? Just makes you feel all patriotic, doesn't it? Oh, I can't stand myself if I do this. Well, it's handy if you make me. I've got Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA ready to go. So that's just a warning. So we've got the pastors who are idiots. But ever so much more than that, let's go to the New York Times. And this is kind of, well, damning with faint praise. Lisa Hymas, writing over at Grist, notes that the New York Times published an op-ed calling for Barack Obama to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. They got it right. But in getting it right, they also got it wrong. Because the lobster for lunch crowd at the New York Times editorial board said, in itself, the Keystone Pipeline will not push the world into a climate apocalypse, but it will continue to fuel our appetite for oil and add to the carbon load in the atmosphere. There is no need to accept it. Morons. Climate apocalypse? No, you dumb bastards. We're already in that. How can you be the New York Times, which just lived through Sandy just a Halloween ago, and throw around a term like climate apocalypse as if there's something a little more apocalyptic on the way? But, you know, the New York Times will tell us when we get it. No, that was, no, that's not climate. That's not climatic apocalypse. No, that's not that. We'll let you know. Bodies floating face down in the water during Katrina. That wasn't apocalyptic. No. Walls of wind going 80 miles an hour, blowing across the entire Midwestern section of the United States. Nothing apocalyptic in that. Giant badass snowstorms, humongous heat waves, an entire most of an entire state catching fire. Nope, not apocalyptic, says the New York Times. Jesus. But at least they said that he should reject it, right? At the very least, saying no to the Keystone XL will slow down plans to triple tar sands production from just under 2 million barrels a day now to 6 million barrels a day by 2030. But that ain't going to be apocalyptic. But at least they got the right answer. They got to it the wrong way, but at least they got the right answer. Heck, Michael, I didn't even know I didn't even know there was one. Oh! Oh, Michael's on. Subject line, Lee Greenwood. Hey, Bob, do you have the live version of God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood? I hear that's quite an extraordinary rendition. Michael will, I hope, be with us for the remainder of the show. Don't forget to tip your server and try the veal. Or don't try the veal. Jesus only knows what kind of antibiotics it's had. So that's half of the New York Times nomination for this Moran Monday. But only half. Then there's Thomas Friedman, who found a little bit of room in his lavish spaces for entertaining to write an op-ed piece that was also published this past Sunday. In his infinite wisdom, that's called sarcasm, Friedman says that Obama will probably go ahead and approve the Keystone XL pipeline, something which I think there's a majority of us who also think that, if for no other reason than the fact that he was talking about needing modern pipelines during his State of the Union address. So in saying that he expects President Obama to give the green light to the Keystone XL pipeline, and we certainly have discussed at length why we think that is, Friedman then helpfully offers a suggestion. I hope, he writes, that Bill McKibben and his 350.org coalition go crazy. I'm talking chain themselves to the White House fence, stop traffic at the Capitol kind of crazy. Because I think if we all make enough noise about this, we might be able to trade a lousy Keystone pipeline for some really good systemic responses to climate change. So Thomas Friedman is arguing, at the same time that he's invoking the name of Bill McKibben, he's arguing that the thing that Bill McKibben calls the biggest climate bomb in recent history, well, we should just let it go ahead. And then 350.org and people associated and affiliated with it should go crazy. Words mean things, Tom. I know there's probably a lot of echo in your lavish space for entertaining, but words mean things, especially for a guy who's apparently now, even as we speak, at Yale, teaching a class in humility, lavish spaces for entertaining humility. That, by the way, is how a report on his new mansion somewhere outside D.C. describes the property that he purchased. It has lavish spaces for entertaining. You know, like fiddling while Rome burns. Or pontificating while the planet does the same. Words mean things, though. He wants Bill McKibben and his 350.org coalition to go crazy. Because that's what it is when you feel so motivated, so concerned, so outright terrified for the future of humanity upon this planet that you lock down at the White House or you stop traffic at the Capitol. That is going crazy. You know what's crazy? Not doing it. Not doing it. when the actions largely of 1% of the population of this country are putting an entire planet's population in peril, not doing anything about it is crazy, if we're going to throw that word around. I'm not real wild about the word crazy to begin with. Crazy! Try that again. Crazy! Go crazy. Now, here is Thomas Friedman's reasoning. I think if we all make enough noise about this, we might be... Okay, that's two we's. I think if we all make enough noise about this, we might be able to trade a lousy Keystone Pipeline for some really good systemic responses to climate change. So cue up the protests and pay no attention to people counseling irrational and mature behavior. Time out again, Tom. The fact that one is willing and able to put one's liberty, one's freedom, in jeopardy in no wise implies that that choice is neither rational nor mature. What a dumb bastard. I mean stupid, with a capital stupid. I watched a year or so ago as a woman in a headscarf engaged in a terminal struggle with cancer, engaged in civil disobedience in front of the White House of the United States, and was arrested. And she was in her 60s. Perhaps lavish Thomas Friedman would like... Well, I don't think he can because she's not here anymore. But perhaps lavish Thomas Friedman would like to tell her that her actions on that day, with the very essence of life draining away from her, were irrational and immature. Morons! God! Like finding out you got roaches. Pay no attention to people counseling rational and mature behavior. I think if we all make enough noise about this, we might be able to trade a lousy Keystone Pipeline for some really good systemic responses to climate change. There's an old joke out there in which the Lone Ranger and Tonto, this might be deemed slightly insensitive. I do not intend it that way. It is merely an old joke. But there is an old joke out there where the Lone Ranger and Tonto find themselves surrounded by a band of hostile indigenous people. And the Lone Ranger realizes they're in bad trouble, and that the end, in fact, may be near. And he turns to his boon companion and says, "Well, Tonto, old friend, I guess it's the end of the line for us." And Tonto turns to him and says, "What do you mean, us, Paleface?" So, we, Mr. Friedman, we are making enough noise. We, being able to trade a lousy Keystone Pipeline for some really good systemic responses to climate change. We, Tom, if I can call you Tom, if you can hear me calling you Tom down there at the far end of your lavish spaces for entertaining. And before you can throw around, and in language land, Tom, we call that the first person plural pronoun, that we business. Before you can throw around the first person plural, you gotta make yourself a part of the process whereby the first person plural pronoun references you. So, tell you what, Tom. Next time, because I'm pretty sure you probably... Yeah, you get the press releases. Hell, if little old Bob Kincaid gets the press releases, you gotta be getting the press releases, Tom. Next time you get a press release from 350.org and Bill McKibben, and it starts out with something like, "Dear friend," take them at their word. Understand that they really are decent, kind, upstanding, genial, moral, ethical people who are actually at one and the same time both mature and rational. And when they say, "Y'all come on down to the White House and just sit down and say no for a spell," well, you just take them up on the offer, Tom, you moron. Supercilious bastard. Yes, Benedict, that is exactly what Tom Friedman is saying. That he's okay with the folks of 350.org and people who don't have lavish spaces for entertaining and a lot less money than him. He's okay with them going and sitting down and getting arrested to save the world for him. Does it get much more 1% than that?
Oh, Muffy, let's do watch the little people get arrested so that our asses won't roast. Or flood. Or blizzard.
Breathtaking, isn't it? And so, never having been much of an environmentalist himself, Tom wants to give us all a little bit of advice, because he is, after all, an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He says, if Keystone gets approved, environmentalists should have a long shopping list ready, starting with a price signal that discourages the use of carbon-intensive fuels in favor of low-carbon energy. Nothing would do more to clean our air, drive clean tech innovation, weaken pro-petro dictators, and reduce the deficit than a carbon tax!
Tom? Buddy?
Now, I realize that this is civics and everything, and you're a specialist in humility, so you might be a little bit outside your element. But a carbon tax, Tom, would have to be passed through the... Come on, you can do it. Congress. And one half of that Congress right now is controlled by... Come on, this is just like a standardized test. Lunatics. Who are no more likely to pass a carbon tax than they are to, you can do it, Tom, jump over the moon. So in other words, what Tom Friedman is saying here is, well, you know, he's going to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, and that sure does suck for y'all. But why don't y'all get ready and demand that he do some crap that he can't do, he being President Obama, that he can't do, and y'all just pour your effort into that and lock yourself down to the White House And meanwhile, I'll be sitting here in my lavish spaces for entertaining. I mean, I know there are some people who are pretty well disconnected from reality. But Lord God, what Congress does he think is presently in session? What would have to happen inside the thin gray settlings between the ears that slosh and slop around and pass for brains inside John Boner for something like a carbon tax to happen? Now, it is nice that we have empirical evidence that a carbon tax does not bring on the absolute collapse of civilization. Everything the right wing doesn't like is promised will bring on the absolute collapse of civilization, raising the minimum wage, extending unemployment benefits, returning the tax rates to the Clinton-era tax rates, which are nowhere near as high as they ought to be on the 1%. All those things are absolutely, they're going to bring on the end of civilization as we know it, which one must admit probably means that these people are working with a definition of civilization that is not the same as yours or mine. But it is nice to know that there is empirical evidence that a carbon tax does not bring on the end of civilization. I had a note just a little bit ago from Robert down in Australia. They've had a carbon tax for what, Robert, about a year now? No bread riots. No atonal music. Six-pack of Budweiser has not risen to $1,400. And no one is, in the words of the hopefully soon indicted Don Blankenship, freezing to death in the dark. It can be done. It really, really can be done, and to the general benefit of society as a whole. You know, community. Thomas Friedman. Now, if you really want a right smart giggle, we'll go into the rest of his reasoning. Remember, a few minutes ago, we read, nothing would do more to clean our air, drive clean tech innovation, weaken petro-dictators, and reduce the deficit than a carbon tax. One prays. Yeah, this really is a praying kind of a situation, because it's damn sure not going to happen in reality. Pray in one hand, Friedman. Pray in one hand. One prays this will become part of the budget debate. Oh, God. The budget debate? The budget debate that's going to focus on whether or not Granny's doing too much useless eating, Tom? Also, the president can use his authority under the Clean Air Act to order reductions in CO2 emissions from existing coal power plants and refiners by, say, 25%. He could do that. He could. And where we on the so-called left have a hard time getting people to show up for... I mean, granted, it was a heck of an undertaking for the folks at 350 to get 35,000 people on the mall a couple of weeks ago. Where we have to bust our ass for something like that. If Barack Obama did this, Americans for Prosperity, the Koch suckers, and the rest of them would have 500,000 people on the mall day after tomorrow with pitchforks and torches. He's trying to make us freeze to death in the dark. Friedman continues. He could then do with the power companies what he did with autos, negotiate with them over the fairest way to achieve that reduction in different parts of the country. What do you... Should... I don't know. His column should be retitled Dispatches from an Alternate Universe. And you know what's going to make Barack Obama do all this? Friedman says, we need the president to be able to say to the GOP oil lobby, I'm going to approve this, but it will kill me with my base. Sasha and Malia won't even be talking to me, so I've got to get something really big in return. Really big? You Kenyan Muslim socialist hater of colonialism with a deep-seated hatred of white people? Something really big? Here's something really big. Instead of calling you a Kenyan Muslim socialist, we'll just call you a Kenyan socialist. We'll dump the Muslim part. That's real big for us. I wonder if they've even got gravity in that alternate universe that Thomas Friedman lives in. That alternate universe where the people who don't chain themselves to the White House fence are the rational ones and the mature ones. Prick. Benedict says, no, don't blame Tom for his alternate universe. It's the only one he's ever known. And no, they don't have any gravity. They just suck. Meanwhile, this from Sandra. 2012, rise in CO2 levels, second highest in 54 years. Via the Associated Press. The amount of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the air jumped dramatically in 2012, making it very unlikely that global warming can be limited to another 2 degrees, as many global leaders have hoped, new federal figures show. Scientists say the rise in CO2 reflects the world's economy revving up and burning more fossil fuels, especially in China. Didn't know they had that much fossil fuels. Because, you know, God forbid we should talk about the United States' role in enabling that. Carbon dioxide levels jumped by 2.67 parts per million since 2011 to total just under 395 parts per million. You'll notice 395 is bigger than 350 by 45. That, via the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that that same Congress that's going to pass the carbon tax would very much like to just defund altogether. More coal-burning power plants, especially in the developing world, are the main reason emissions keep going up, even as they have declined in the U.S. and other places, in part through conservation and cleaner energy. It makes you wonder. No, I'm not going there. It's too complicated. For me, not y'all. Too complicated. Only 1998 had a bigger annual increase in carbon dioxide, the primary greenhouse gas. That year, 2.93 parts per million of CO2 was added. From 2000 to 2010, the world averaged a yearly rise of just under 2 parts per million. Levels rose by less than 1 part per million in the 1960s. That's a very fancy numerical way of saying, you know what? We may be effed. Yeah, ain't that the truth, Michael? No, Bob. No gravity. They're just floating. That's an inside joke for all the drive-by truckers fans out there. So there's that. That and a whole bunch more, including, but not limited to, here we go. Something that hit earlier today. Really kind of, and we've talked about this in the past, the sort of, what would we call it, the, idiocratization presently ongoing in Louisiana. It was a few months ago we talked about the Bob Jones history, the Bob Jones textbook series that's being used by Christian homeschooling parents. Those books are now being used in the voucher-driven public schools of Louisianistan, where Piyush Jindal is. Just as a refresher from that previous story, the United States History for Christian Schools, 3rd edition, Bob Jones University Press, 2001, is in use in the voucher schools in Louisiana. It claims in its text, this is a direct quote from the text, the Ku Klux Klan in some areas of the country tried to be a means of reform, fighting the decline in morality and using the symbol of the cross. Klan targets were bootleggers, wife beaters, and immoral movies. In some communities, it achieved a certain respectability as it worked with politicians. Really? The Klan wasn't engaged in race-based hate and outright murder? By the way, do I need to remind you that Bob Jones University in South Carolina is a Christian school? Also from United States History for Christian Schools, 2nd Edition, Bob Jones University Press, 1991, a few slaveholders were undeniably cruel. Examples of slaves beaten to death were not common, neither were they unknown. The majority of slaveholders treated their slaves well. Except for that whole slave part. Life Science, 3rd edition, Bob Jones University Press, 2007, says, Bible-believing Christians cannot accept any evolutionary interpretation. Dinosaurs and humans were definitely on the earth at the same time and may have even lived side by side within the past few thousand years. These are textbooks that are really, no kidding, honest to God, in use with taxpayer money in Louisianistan. Not kidding. Of course, whenever we get around to the argument that dinosaurs and humans live together, you have to go to this from the Horn's chosen prophet. You just have to.
That's another good thing about Bush being gone, man, because for the last 12 years with Reagan and Bush, we have had fundamentalist Christians in the White House. Fundamentalist Christians who believe the Bible is the exact word of God, including that wacky fire and brimstone Revelations ending.
By the way, it is worth reminding folks who are not necessarily familiar with Bill Hicks that he died in the 1990s. This sounds like he said it a couple of years ago. But I digress. Let us go back to the prophet. Peace be upon him.
Have had their finger on the fucking button for 12 years. Tell me when, Lord. Tell me when. Let me be your servant, Lord. Fundamentalist Christianity. Fascinating. These people actually believe the world is 12,000 years old.
Actually, no, Bill. It's six.
Based on what? I asked them. Well, we looked at all the people in the Bible and we added them up all the way back to Adam and Eve. Their ages, 12,000 years. Well, that's fucking scientific. Okay. I didn't know that you'd gone to so much trouble there. That's good. You believe the world's 12,000 years old. Is that true? Okay, I got one word to ask you. One word question. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Dinosaur. You know, the world's 12,000 years old and dinosaurs existed, and they existed in that time. You think it would have been mentioned in the fucking Bible at some point. And oh, Jesus and the disciples walked to Nazareth, but the trail was blocked by a giant brontosaurus with a splinter in his paw. And oh, the disciples did run a-shrieking, "What a big fucking lizard, Lord!" But Jesus was unafraid, and he took the splinter from the brontosaurus' paw, and the big lizard became his friend. And Jesus sent him to Scotland, where he lived in a lock for oh so many years, inviting thousands of American tourists to bring their fat fucking families and their fat dollar bills. And oh, Scotland did praise the Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord.
Yeah, see, you have to play that whenever you get around to the... That's a real textbook. But that's all just set up. Because there's a new book. It's in the eighth grade, mind you. Eighth graders in voucher-driven, taxpayer-funded religion schools in Louisiana have a book from which they are ostensibly learning the U.S. history book and there's a discussion in this U.S. history book on hippies. And it says, and this is a quote from the textbook, talking about draft dodgers and hippies. They went to Canada or European countries to escape being drafted into military service. Well, not everybody who didn't want to do military service went to Canada or European countries. Some of them went, "Daddy!" and got themselves sent to the Texas Air National Guard. And a little bit later, not going to Canada or European countries, they just decided not to show up for duty anymore and enrolled in master's degree classes at Harvard instead. George W. Bush. But that's not the biggest problem with this section from the text. Somewhere Dr. John is screaming. Many young people turned to drugs and immoral lifestyles. These youth became known as hippies. Wait a minute, it's all in bold. Let's get this right. Many young people turned to drugs and immoral lifestyles. These youth became known as hippies. They went without bathing, wore dirty, ragged, unconventional clothing. What does that mean, unconventional clothing?
Love beads, man.
They're kidney beads.
They're love beads.
And deliberately broke all codes of politeness or manners. They stopped wiping their feet when they come in the door. They didn't floss after brushing. Sometimes they didn't brush. No, that part's not in there. And deliberately broke all codes of politeness or manners. You know, because it's impolite to protest an unjust war. It's a definite display of bad manners. If you object to the slaughter of more than a million innocent civilians in a far off place called Vietnam, yes, they deliberately broke all codes of politeness or manners. Rock music played an important part in the hippie movement and had great influence over the hippies. Rock music, yes. I don't know. Why is it that when I read that passage, I immediately hear, let me see if I've got it here so you can hear it too. Yeah, there it is. So let's get this set up right. Okay. Rock music played an important part in the hippie movement and had great influence over the hippies.
When the truth is found to be
Can't you just see the hippies are dancing away in their unconventional clothing? And just a flapping around with no politeness nor manners whatsoever. Oh my. Yeah. This just kind of begs for a whole interlude. Yeah. Okay. This does, yeah. Many of the rock musicians they followed belonged to Eastern religious cults or practiced Satan worship. Among you. The name of the book is America, Land I Love.
got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman. I've got a black magic woman. Got me so blind I can see. That she's a black magic woman. She kind of make a devil out of me. Turn your back on me, baby.
Your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
I had to. I just had to. Those two songs. When you hear that shriek. Melodic though it is, but that shriek of Grace Slick with the opening of her query, when the truth is found to be lies and all the joy within you dies. Don't you want somebody to love? Yeah. That's the immoral lifestyle You don't want to be asking questions like that when the truth within you dies. Or, yeah. When the truth is found to be lies and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? That is a sign of a sure enough immoral lifestyle. And although this portion, this constitutes dancing about architecture, talking about a photograph on the radio, this passage, which was reproduced in a post by John Aravosis over at AmericaBlog.com, the next book, America, Land I Love, the scan includes the photograph that goes with the passage. And it is simply labeled hippies. But the fact of the matter is, apart from one rather outlandish fro, which is incidentally on a white guy, you couldn't tell this from day before yesterday, just about anywhere in America. It's a group of young people seated on a wall of sorts. One guy has a guitar that he's playing. There is one person of color in the group. He was chosen because he's lifting a... the photograph was probably chosen because the black man is raising a bottle to his lips. Remember, they were living immoral lifestyles. There are, as far as I can tell, at least three women in the group. Probably, you know, it's not just that they wore unconventional clothing. They refused to wear the conventional clothing because it looks like one of the women in the group does not have her godly and Christ-like maiden form brassiere on. Possibly two of them don't. Hippies. And, of course, it's nice and grainy and grayscaled. The guy with the fro is apparently playing, has a pair of sticks in his hands. He's apparently keeping time with the guy in the vest playing the guitar. There's another guy who looks a little bit like Bill Murray who doesn't have a shirt on. Hippies! And remember, the morons want this to be, for all intents and purposes, the textbook for all of our children. Deliberately broke all codes of politeness or manners. They's wearing white after Labor Day, eating their food with any old fork on the table, burping and protesting a war that Jesus Christ himself supported in Vietnam. You know, it's the fact that it neglects to mention that there were overtones of a desire to, well, don't you want somebody to love? Substituting instead Eastern religion and Satan worship. You know, the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil is one of the most brilliant lyrics ever penned in rock and roll history, and among the most profound. But that idea, Sympathy for the Devil, which was actually a rather old concept in the English language, became a rallying cry for fundamentalists in this country. proof of the demonic influence that rock and roll was having on our youth. So too, the line in Don McLean's American Pie, which I will not play, in which he refers to seeing Satan laughing with delight the day the music died. Because even the mention is like Beetlejuice to these fundamentalist morons. One more time, be right here. Under the subject line, Louisiana Stan, Jack writing in from Shreveport. First, let me say how I am oh so proud. Oh, yes. Oh, so proud. Second, let me say that upon one of the meetings upon the town hall that I attended, both the scourge of hippies and the scourge of drugs were, verily, brought up by the congressman and were thus, verily, brought up by the congregation. I have no other word for them. And yes, that is true. I am thus exhausted here in Louisiana Stan. Jim, noting, rightly, one did not have to be wrapped up in the counterculture, as it was then known, to be into Grace Slick and Santana. And that's the, like I said, rightly, that is the truth. But this is not about factuality. This is about revisionism. This is about rewriting history and giving it to impressionable children to explain an otherwise incomprehensible world into which they are about to be cast, damn near naked, with no social protections, no social safety net, bupkis. God, I'd love to see the section on race music. Dr. John writing in. See, I knew he'd be screaming. Subject line, hippies? Let's see. Long hair, seldom bathing, wandering with a bunch of like-minded people, property in common, committed to peace and love, and perhaps the occasional hallucinogen. Bob? Wasn't Jesus himself one of the original hippies? Yes! Absolutely. But just like the new Bible TV show that's on some dumbass cable channel, we all know that that wasn't the real Jeebus. The real Jeebus, just like the guy in the new TV show, was white, 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 white. I mean, that's how everybody knew he was the Son of God. Because there, all them brown people, was this pale, blue-eyed, blonde-haired, white guy walking around preaching love and harmony. Don't watch that thing, by the way. Now, see, I read a story from Salon saying it was premiering. This is more in Monday, after all. That this show, The Bible, brought to you by the Survivor Guy, was premiering. But I saw something calling itself The Bible last week and just had a fit on the Twitter about it. Because, among other things, the avenging angels who took down Sodom, well, one of them looked a hell of a lot like George Takei, only, well, the young Mr. Sulu. But he turned out to be an angel who was a two-katana-wielding ninja. At least there weren't throwing stars. And the young Moses was a drag queen in a pencil skirt with enough eyeliner on to, oh dear God, and a shaven head. I'm so not. I can't. Ordinarily, that's the kind of thing I would take for the team and watch or try to. But I can't. My mental health is, I guess, a little bit fragile right now. And I can't. I'm sorry. So I should note here, nearly halfway through the program, well, see, I was Isaac, I was trying not to bring up what channel it's on, but yeah, that's a valid query. Isaac asking, why is the Bible on the History Channel? And see, I saw that section on the Exodus, and I'm going, what? Because you'd think if several thousand people, in fact, an entire generation of people, wandered around the desert for 40 years before getting where they were going, you'd think somebody would have broke a sandal strap. Somebody would have lost a bronze buckle, something. But nowhere, nada, nothing. Not a single shred of evidence to support that the Exodus ever even happened. So why indeed, Isaac, why is the Bible on the History Channel? And why is one of the avenging angels a dual katana-wielding ninja? Yeah, well. I gotta admit, the You know the number, 304-658-3333. Or via Skype, you can jump in. And the Skype handle here is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Bob Kincaid Horn. Maybe I'm not logged in. I don't know. We'll find out. But if I'm not, I will be. To the phones we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Are you talking to me?
I'm talking to you, Bill.
Are you talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Oh, okay. You know, you keep playing that music, I'll lose a lot of years, you know. I was never crazy about the airplane, but the woman had one hell of a voice.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that shrieked inquiry, you know, when the truth is found to be lies.
Yeah, that particular song, I saw her work in Cleveland in the Dark Ages, I guess. She was a pretty girl. If you like hippies, which I unfortunately did too much, so strange bunch of kids. I was a little older than they were, Bob. I was born in 43. So when they hit, you know, the 60s, I was already, I hit 21 the year after Kennedy was,
64.
Following January. I had a distinct birth. I was the,
You're the New Year's guy.
Yeah, I was a New Year's baby here in Cleveland, and I had a doctor, I think he held me back because he wanted a New Year's baby, and I've been late for everything ever since, so what the hell, you know? Boy, when you play that stuff, you're talking to me, and, I saw so much of it, so much of the protests were, and they were correct. I mean, there's no doubt about it. To me, I look back at an American general. What was his name? He commanded the airborne, 82nd Airborne, and two when he commanded on the ground in Korea after what's his name got killed. Walton Walker died. This guy, I can't think of his name, but when Eisenhower asked him whether we should relieve the siege of Dien Bien Phu, he just said point blank, "No way." In 1954. Yeah, he was airborne general. I can't think of his name. I'm getting senile, you know. Because, sometimes a good person in that field knows you don't do it because it's a loser and there's no ethicism or whatever you want to call it to it. You just don't get involved. You stay away from it, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm proud when I see a guy do that. Hell, even MacArthur was calling later on in years when he had a conference with Kennedy where he supposedly told Kennedy stay out of a land war in Asia. And, of course, we've gone it even one worse. We've now surrendered our manufacturing and our economy to Asia, which doesn't sit well with people like me who Remember, I'm from that generation where if a guy wanted to do something for a living and he learned how to do it, he could do it. I imagine your dad was one. You put something in front of that guy, he could probably fix it.
Yeah, it's one of the things I imagined, or always, that's one of the things I always admired about him, and one of the things that I didn't get along the way.
Well, you didn't have to, Bob. You got something that, you know, I mean, that was what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to go to college and get a degree, and but when you're living in the inner-city housing project, I lived in a place just like, who's the guy that follows you?
Rick Smith.
Yeah, Rick. We discussed that little factor, that we're both project kids. And I've talked to one of our good music buddies about how a young white kid got involved playing blues when you heard it all around you, when your neighbors were playing it. And I'll tell you, I've told this buddy of ours, so you know who it is. He's out of Ohio. It's a blessing to have that introduction. And I think you picked it up and ran with it, too. The blessing of meeting people from another races and falling and walking alongside of them instead of chasing them or being chased by them, you know, because that's the other difference in this society that scares the living crap out of me. Where I lived, there was always somebody to fight with. In fact, I don't know how much you know about Cleveland, but I was eight blocks south of an area that was full of folks from West by God in Tennessee. They'd come up here looking for work.
Sure.
Some of them got it, and some of them became good old-fashioned all-American juvenile freaking delinquents, you know? And since I didn't have a twang in my voice, I kind of punched that short, fat guy over there, you know? Because that was so common in the 60s, that was a big change in the 70s that I saw with the, but there was plenty of anger and fighting between hippies and, I knew so many of these kids that were hippies up in Cleveland that, and musically they accepted me early.
Can you imagine, Bill, that in America, Land I Love textbook being delivered to innocent little eighth graders in Louisiana, that all it has to say, they were immoral and dirty and they didn't bathe and they wore unconventional clothing and didn't have no manners.
Well, I'll tell you what, a lot of these kids that were involved with the hippie movement were upper class kids. These were not your working class or your lower class kids. They didn't accept that. That mostly was Cleveland Heights and Shaker Heights and areas like that. That's where the leadership came from for that group of human beings in the anti-war movement. And I attended protests, and but I would argue with the guys that were in the anti-war movement. I said, look, don't go burning crap and doing things that piss people off. I said, you're gonna fire these idiots up and they'll come down on you like a, I was playing, you remember the old hullabaloos? Were they still have those when you were a young man? The dance clubs that were, they were like a corporation. You bought a location, and you brought in bands, mostly local guys.
I was around a couple of those later on when I was a teenager.
Yeah, I was playing in Lake County on a Saturday night. And guys came in and said, well, we burned the ROTC building tonight. So you know what month it was. If I'm not mistaken, it was the end of April. I have to go back. It could have been the exact beginning. It could have been May 1st. Because what was Kent State, May 2nd, the shootings?
Thereabouts.
Yeah. And when these kids told me they had burned the ROTC building in Kent, I said, man, you're going to pay a price for that.
Yeah, Kent State was May 4th.
Yeah, it was May 4th. So it was actually the beginning of May when I was playing in Lake County, which is one county east of Cleveland, and one of those hullabaloos, as I called them. And how we ever snuck in there, the club owners was amazed that people were listening to something like blues. And, you know, and he couldn't feel it. Because we were not a Beatles imitator, you know?
Yeah.
We imitated somebody else, you know? I mean, what the hell? If you're going to do it, imitate somebody you like better. But in all seriousness, I had told these kids that somebody's going to pay a price for burning that RTC building. I never expected it to be for good. I still didn't like the idea because of what it stirs up in the idiot's brain box. If you're going to go out and kick the idiot's ass, then that's a different story, you know? Go out and do it. I'll take General Yap any day of the week, you know. Hit and run and disappear into the darkness and beat your opponent. But I felt that somebody was going to pay a price for that. And, of course, there was a truck strike going on. And National Guard and the truckers were not exactly getting along, but nobody was. You didn't see the NG guys shooting the truckers because you know why?
No.
Truckers might shoot back.
Well, true.
The truckers were older men and men of all ages who had fought through the labor movement, and you don't want to lean on those guys too much because they might get back. It's the old story. And, of course, when that happened at Kent State, I just about fell off my chair when I heard the news. I didn't know anybody involved with it, but there was... I knew a lot of the weathermen types and that around Cleveland that were, they didn't impress me as being good revolutionaries, these guys. I don't think they could throw a left hook, much less, you know, shoot somebody. A lot of these kids talked revolution, but people don't realize what they're talking when they talk revolution. How it is, you know. That's your department. You understand that stuff. But you hit it tonight with the music and with the, you hit it right on the button, man. That stuff was, what a time. And like I told this one fella, who's very hip in R&B, which is not my long suit. I mean, early R&B, Marvin Gaye and people like this. What was his name? One sax player. We used to do Roadrunner that he did and a few others. This guy would tear the high end off a saxophone. He was a Motown recording artist and I can't think of his name right offhand. Can you, sax man?
No,
before your time, Bob.
I'm looking here, but I will be told post day.
Roadrunner, baby. That was the line. We used to close the set with that. And then these other guys, from the guy we know, they...
Junior Walker?
Yeah, Walker. Man, that guy could tear a saxophone apart. I don't know whether he was biting the reed. I was a bad clarinet player. I was as big as Benny Goodman, and that's as far as it got. I used to also say that my hands only work fast enough if I had a knife in one and a fork in the other. Then the clarinetist needed to get around. But there's, I don't know, what can we, what I see happening, I'm old and Cleveland Clinic's giving me crap about heart stuff, but hey, when you have a heart attack when you're 51, you can expect, my old man passed away from it when he was 64, in 1964 when he was 57, so we inherit what we have, you know. You had some problems. Were they family? What you're going through, is that family stuff?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I'm a cholesterol factory. Yeah. I'm a triglyceride factory.
Yeah, that's something. Guys from down south are born that way.
Well, I think it's not just down south. It's some of it's genetic. It has to do with heritage, because the fact of the matter is, evolution is a very, very slow process, and it works on populations, not individuals. And that's a hard one to get your mind around sometimes. But the fact of the matter is, I'm still dealing with a physiology that was evolved for purposes of living where it's very cold, where being able to manufacture and store fats is an evolutionary plus, not a negative. And also, there's a history of bad hearts that runs down the Kincaid side of the family. And
the old man smoke?
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, Bob.
Yep.
Yeah.
One of these days I'm going to check into the Betty Ford anti-smoking clinic and get done with this.
Well, every time you go to buy a pack of cigarettes, you're checking into it, whether you know it or not. But then again, all of us cheap old people have got very good cigarette rolling machines.
Yeah.
And we can handle it. We can do it. You know, we do that. So it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. But, Bob, I'm old, and it bothers me that I'm not going to be around to stand up to these people, to do what... I had my shot once. And it was a funny life. This minister had a... Did I tell you the story? He had a church in East Cleveland, Ohio, which was, in those days, very white middle class. And it was a church that was Unitarian Universalist, and it was running... Hell, we played church services in those days for him. And he came here from Chicago, where the church he was working in Chicago had been bought by the Reverend Mr. Dr. Wright. You know who I'm speaking
to. Yeah, sure.
And I said, man, what a freaking small world it is. Every time you turn around, your nose is hitting somebody's fist that you know something about. That you that had a thing. And I don't know, what got you rolling to the good side of politics? What got you moving?
Oh, I was started from the cradle that way. My parents were literally children of the Depression. They were both 18 years old in 1943.
Yep.
They saw what would have happened to their communities had the New Deal not come along and had FDR not intervened, and I was raised an FDR style Democrat.
Yeah, you too. Yep, me.
Because the way it worked out, I wound up having what were considered older parents. You know, most of my peer group's parents were, you know, in their mid to late 20s, early 30s when my friends' parents were born. Well, my parents were 40 when I was born. And
your dad was a World War II vet, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and your uncle.
And so, you know, I'm literally the next to last year of what is officially termed the baby boom.
Yep.
And for the longest time as a child, I thought it rather unfortunate that I didn't, that my parents were different from other people's parents because they weren't as vibrant. They weren't as, they were different. And they were hillbillies in Alabama too, which made a difference.
You were a different guy.
Yeah, there was no direct linkage to the local culture. But now that I look back, I feel like I have benefits by virtue of what I learned firsthand from my parents that the kids I grew up with didn't get, because they had to, you know, they had to get it from grandma or grandpa. I got it. You know, and I got it from my mom and dad, and what I got from my grandmother, I never knew my one grandfather. The other grandfather died when I was five, so not much memory there either. I knew both of my grandmothers, and one of them was constantly passing along information and history, and you know, it's kind of neat when a human being can look at a child and say, let me tell you about the first time I ever saw an airplane fly overhead.
Yes. My grandmother did that to me.
You know, let me tell you about the first telephone in the countryside around there. Let me tell you about what it was like not to have electric lights.
Yeah, that's before my time even. We had those things.
Well, my grandmother was born in 1894.
Yeah, that's...
The first electricity that my mother knew was provided via Delco batteries. You literally went and traded in your old battery and brought a new battery back if you wanted to have electric light in the house. And you conserved electricity ferociously. because you used it.
You didn't listen to the damn radio, portable radio, huh?
Well, and you didn't walk out of a well-lit room. Heck, you probably didn't even turn the lights on until it got dark. So, you know, for me, when these pro-coal thugs, among other folks, Bill, when these pro-coal jackasses talk about how, well, if it wasn't for coal, we'd freeze to death in the dark. And I'm like, you damn fool. We've only had electricity around here for consistent electricity for a good bit under 100 years. Freeze to death in the dark, please.
Yeah, friends of mine who were from the area would tell me about their grandmothers and such talking about the Opry and how important that was to listen to when you had the ability to. Because that was a startup of communication. I was blessed. My mother kept me home from school one day in 1950, or early 51, when MacArthur made a speech to Congress. I saw that done, you know, in the first person. I was only a little kid, but I was one of those goddamn kids who thought he wanted to learn an awful lot. Well, I did learn an awful lot, Bob, but some of it I can't talk about. That sexual revolution was... Man, get on, I'll tell you. There's a woman here who sings, and she had a band that she called Slick at one time, so you know where she was coming from.
Yeah.
She could imitate, and I had the pleasure of doing two shows at Stroessacker Auditorium, which is part of CASE. It was for the Women's Indochina Peace Committee, circa 1975, and we worked with Bonnie Raitt. And my God, could that woman sing? And was she?
Oh, I saw a video of her doing a stand-in on an appearance on the Midnight Special. A friend of mine sent it to me via Facebook. It was Lowell George and Little Feet appearing on the Midnight Special and doing Dixie Chicken, and the background singers were Bonnie Raitt and Emmy Lou Harris.
Oh, my God.
And they looked like they were about 16 years old each. I mean,
I remember Emmy Lou Harris from the folk song magazine Sing Out that a lot of my friends were into. And I taped a show in 1960. It was Folk Song USA. It was the host was a guy named Cisco Houston. Now, Cisco had been a road buddy and a guy who had been shot out of... the North Atlantic with Woody Guthrie. And the lead vocal, the lead person to start that show was a 17-year-old Hispanic woman named Joan Baez. And just, I had the tape finally. You know how a tape is.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad was a tape guy, and he got me started with mono tape. And, of course, after so many years, it shreds, and you can't use it anymore. But
You know what? I got a tape story. I was talking to a fellow the other day, and he was telling me about his dissolute youth. And he said that once upon a time, it's a little community not too far from here, was a substantial town once upon a time, as were many towns in this state, which are now, you know, simply decaying and being reclaimed by the mountain forests. But he and some buddies had grabbed some beers, and there was a DJ who jocked on the local AM station, and he pre-recorded his show. And he would mix in whatever records he wanted to play. And he had a little recording rig going up in the attic of his home. And it included what was then, you know, back in the early 70s, a great damn big reel-to-reel tape recorder.
Oh, yeah.
And you remember what those looked like.
Yeah.
And it was, and it was mono. Not, you know, it's two-track business. Mono. And so they were sitting around up there, and he was mixing his rock and roll radio show for the local radio station. And apparently, he didn't have curtains on the attic window, and the nosy, paranoid little old Baptist lady neighbor called the cops on him.
Oh, boy.
Not because they were making too much noise, Bill. Not because they were drinking and... You know, having sexual liberation up there in the attic. No. She called the cops on him because she saw that reel-to-reel recorder and absolutely was convinced that there were Russian spies living right next door to her.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
They're in Mount Hope, West Virginia. And so the cop shows up, knocks on the door, and goes, listen, I know this is it, but the lady next door thinks you're a Russian spy. Can I see what it is that's bothering her? So, oh, yeah, come on up. They take the cop up to the attic, show him the... Oh, you're him? Oh, yeah. I listen all the time.
Yeah. Well, hell, you work for a man who...
But, you know, the mere presence of a reel-to-reel tape recorder would be an...
Yeah.
The Russian spice.
Yeah, it was pretty strange in those days, and...
Well, I got to tell you, Bill, you got a note in from Dr. John here, and this is really, really kind. He says, tell Bill to knock off talking about himself like he's old and in the way. As a younger but no longer young person, I'm increasingly aware that we live in a social, political, and cultural moment that has both a past and a future. We all owe a debt to the artists and activists and generally good people who came before us. Paying that debt means, in part, living up to the example we've inherited. We do this so the people who follow us will inherit a better world than the one we lived in. Listening to Bill talk, it's clear that he's fought the fight in his way, like we all do, and he continues to do it by his very being. Much love and respect. Signed, John.
Is that the Dr. John I'm thinking of?
Yeah, that's Dr. John.
Yeah. Well, it's not the guy from New Orleans.
No, different Dr. John. Yeah.
Although one of my sidemen ended up recording with Dr. John on the album entitled Gumbo. He played on that.
I remember that one.
Yeah, guys were... I think he was... They did Stagger Lee, and I think that was... Because we used to do that song. We did the... what's his name? Lloyd Price basic version of Stagger Lee, my God. And one of the biggest thrills of my life was something I just learned a couple of years ago. They were bringing New Orleans jazz bands up to Cleveland. In 61 and 2. So I go to hear these guys, and I meet an old man in his 80. And he's calling me sir, and I finally had to tell him, you're sir. I'm Bill. I'm 18, you're 80. You're sir. And this guy had, what I heard a few years ago, was this guy had played with the, who was that trumpet player from New Orleans? I'm getting senile, I can't remember names. This was the guy who was officially recognized as the first New Orleans jazz trumpet player, Buddy Bolden. And Bolden was a good hard case musician. He ended up in a mental hospital. He might have been one of those guys who liked to drink shoe polish, you know. There are a few of those guys around, you know. I'm sure you've seen plenty. Yeah. Not me either, but, you know, there was people who would do anything. And
yeah, the rubbing alcohol guys, the shaving lotion guys.
Yes, you know, I hear the stuff that colleges are playing today, and some of it just leaves me cold, but I guess that's a guy who starts out listening to Goodman and Armstrong and then later Chicago blues players. And
well, that's that moment where I look up and realize that I, too, have gone geezer. But every now and then, I try to keep my hand in, and I try to listen to some new stuff, but, I'm genre-based. I know what I like. And every now and then I'm reminded that no, it's just that this is not a function of either you or me not getting it. It is the fact that what is put out there for popular mass consumption now, Bill, via the for-profit broadcast industry, is mostly junk.
Yeah.
It really is. I can't turn on a hot hits station and stay with it for more than 3 or 4 seconds. Because I just...
They're screwing around with that.
But then if I wander onto a website like Bandcamp, good God, there's amazing people out there doing music that is brilliant and underheard and underlistened. And, you know, I've tried to play a track or two here and there.
Well, some of the stuff you play from some of the modern bands who have a country flavor, but what they're saying is totally different. And, I mean, let's face it, I don't know anybody that doesn't like the old man Hank Sr.
Oh.
I know Ray Charles liked it enough to cover a version of I'm Moving On, which I covered after hearing Ray do it. Because when Ray did it, it was Ray's style, but the flavor of of Hank Sr. was coming through. Hank the Third is a different guy than his father. His father lost me politically, not musically. The old man can still, the second kid can still crack out something occasionally and say something that the working class, but they, some of these guys forget the working class. And they forget where they came from. I did jobs like, my first gig was in a knitting factory where we made sweaters, and the machines were all operated off of belts, off the ceiling. I kept looking around and expect to see a 14-year-old kid hauling a box of yarn out from behind a machine. And that was 1960s. And there were some good times. We had a great burlesque house here. And there's some guys that do a comedy show on college radio on Sunday. And these guys have no concept of comedy. They don't have any sense of the history of the movement of comedy. And in the 20s, you go to a vaudeville show and you'd have a, excuse me, let me revert to the vernacular of the show business and not offend anybody. You'd have two Hebe comics.
Yeah.
You'd have Mediterranean comics who had that good Italian accent. And everything was colored by the accent of the speakers. And I'll tell you, I was lucky enough to see the early Amos and Andy stuff, and I know that it was not, there was things that were done that were inappropriate, but the character actors out front were funny men with a long history of vaudeville, and they were good comics. They gave them crap to work with. And of course, the guy who turned that around was Red Fox.
Yeah.
Fox brought in, he brought in all those people on his show were old vaudeville cats. And when I was a kid, if you heard a Red Fox record, I bet it was like,
oh, that. No, it was like that as far as when I was a teenager. You know, if you had only, it wasn't records by then, it was 8-track tapes, and, you know, you'd kind of go off somewhere where nobody'd hear you.
Yeah.
You know, and you hid your Red Fox tapes further away and deeper than you hid the Playboys.
Yeah. You know, who is the young comic who died of pancreatic cancer?
Oh, that was Bill Hicks.
Man, I had a bunch of stuff that people sent me, and it disappeared off of my.
Well, it's all there on YouTube. Just you can go for days on Bill Hicks on YouTube, Bill. And
well, I don't know. Somebody we know has my email address, and if you ever can send me anything that'll lead me to it, I'd sure appreciate it, because that man could bust you up.
Oh, well, that's, you know, that's why I played that clip of him talking about Jesus and the dinosaurs.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he hits it. But I was a funny guy with comedy. Jesus, in 80, a friend of mine brought me to a place in Shaker Square that where Hadassah was running a benefit. And who was the comic? Freaking Henny Youngman.
Yeah.
And that guy was like, it was like getting machine gunned.
Well, there's a progression. You know, George Carlin, very few people realize that George Carlin started out as a straight-laced, suit and tie, stand up, tell the jokes kind of funny man. And then, you know, with the hippies, he transformed into that, the George Carlin that we all know.
Yeah, I saw him too. He was,
you know, the,
yeah.
Who else? Well, I got to talk briefly with him when I was in D.C. last time. Dick Gregory. You know, one of the.
He can still be a funny man.
He is. You know, he's up in his 80s. And he's still just quick as can be. And he's the one. And a lot of people credit this to other people, but it was Dick Gregory who said, if Jesus Christ had been electrocuted, we'd all be walking around with little electric chairs hanging around our necks.
He ran for mayor of Chicago against one of the family of long-term Irish guys. In fact, the one who had everybody beat to crap. What the hell were their names?
The Dailies?
Daly. I mean, I saw that stuff happen on my television set in 1968. I saw all that violence going down. I mean, I was, the hell I should, I was 25. I should know what the hell I was looking at. But Gregory made some comment when he ran against Daley about the vote count. I can't remember. Look it up and you'll get a good laugh from the audience. I'll leave the audience with one of the funniest one-liners I ever heard. This was 63. And the comic's talking about a new drug invented that is good for a man to take because he'll get excited, so to speak. And the punchline made it funny because there was no such thing at the time. And we know there is now. But it was developed by the name of it was developed by the Upjohn Chemical Company. And that was the punchline. That broke me up right there because I thought the whole thing was a huge joke. Of course, I look around me today and say, well, the joke's on you again, Bill. You sucker.
Well, anyway. I got to share this with you because, you know, you're touching little points of impact here and there with people. Sergi just wrote in from Texas, and he said, referring to what is on the hot hits radio stations of today as mostly junk is like referring to John Boner as mostly orange. I myself can't stand much any of it. I may only be 20 years old, but I refuse to partake in what most 20-year-olds of today listen to and find myself going back at least into the mid-90s for good songs to experience. Most of my music library is from the 70s, 80s, 90s, with the odd few least crappy pop songs of the last decade. I have a lot of newer songs that are video game soundtracks, however, thankfully that genre is fairly immune to the pop crap. For an example, I have the entire discography of Marvin Gaye and absolutely love it.
Oh, yeah.
Experiencing that music during its heyday must have been one hell of a cool experience.
Yeah, I've got a recording that you don't have, and I'd like to get it to you. They did a sampler recording here in Cleveland, and the guy, the producer, asked me to do a remake of. Well, I do have it on one of my first, the Blackface CD. We did One More Heartache, and this guy asked me to do it again. Marvin Gaye, Hitchhike. Oh man, that guy broke me up, and that was hard nosed stuff. He wasn't ballads singing lovemaking at the time. He was hitting hard.
There's no squishy in any of that. Not by any stretch of the imagination.
The worst thing about Motown was the managers. You know, the company owners were using those people up like, you know.
Oh yeah, ring them out, hang them out to dry, and look for somebody else. Exactly.
Yeah.
Hey Bill, it is great hearing from you, my friend.
Hey, let's go, man. I've talked enough bullshit tonight myself.
You're doing great. I'm gonna try to get a couple more folks on here.
Well, there's always good people waiting to talk, so let them on, my friend.
All right, take care.
Take care.
All right, have a good night. Our good buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello, Bob.
Yeah.
Andy,
what's up, man?
Hey, how about a box of chocolates and some roses, Bob?
For?
Who else? Your hero.
What are you...
Randy Paul.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Do you know who sent him a box of chocolates and red roses?
Please, don't. I'm afraid to ask.
Code Pink people.
Fuck.
And kisses, too. I knew you'd react well to that.
Oh, God. Looking for the liquor bottle now.
It doesn't really surprise me, Bob, how you're reacting to this filibuster deal.
Well, if it was a filibuster, it would be different. It wasn't.
Yeah, I know you keep saying that.
It was a con, Andy.
He was out there.
But you enter into a filibuster in order to stop something. His intent was never to stop the nomination of John Brennan. His intent was to fundraise on it, which he has done amazingly well with.
Valid.
And he's getting money. He's getting money. From people who call themselves progressives. It's brilliant. somewhere in hell, P.T. Barnum is clapping his little hands together while he's turning on the spit over the barbecue fires.
So, have you heard of a progressive sending Randy Paul some money?
No, but if he's getting roses and chocolates.
Well, that's not money. It's I don't know.
But the fact of the matter is, I have seen stories of the.
I knew you would like that.
The massive that he has been fundraising on it. It was billed. He told Republican leadership before he was going to do it that he was going that it was going to be a fundraiser.
Well, absolutely. He's working his side of the Republican Libertarian part of the party. In the teabagging part of the party.
Right, who are not known
There's money there to be shooken out of the trees. There's no question.
Yeah, who are not known as being the most perceptive political bunch.
Oh, that's an understatement, Bob. Come on. Not perceptive? How about brain dead?
Okay, well, we can go that far. I'll go there with you.
No question about that.
You know, the political equivalent of a rutabaga.
Right. You know, I did on Democracy Now! This morning, Amy Goodman did play a clip of his, we can put filibuster in quotes, but he did mention Awaki's son, the 16-year-old son that was killed during that filibuster, which was nice to bring up, because, you know, during those Senate hearings that they had for John O'Brien, that never came up.
Oh, no.
No Democrat would dare bring up knocking off a 16-year-old boy. And then you have that genius in the White House who actually said he picked the wrong father. That was Awaki's son's mistake. That's why he's a dick.
No, all of the circumstances around
that. We do have a moron sitting in the White House, and I don't know quite what to make of this dude in there. I really do not. All I know is the guy is not on my side. He is not on my team. And when I saw him with this effing guy, Tiger Woods, playing golf, while I'm up there demonstrating, trying to help save the planet, this son of a bee is out there playing golf with another moron. This guy is we have a sick individual in the White House. All right? Something has gone deadly wrong with this dude. All right? That's all I'm
going to
say, man.
No, I agree in large part. I don't think he's a moron. I don't think you can compare like Barack Obama and, you know, a teabagger with a sign.
I think there's something wrong with the wiring.
I think there's something wrong with his value system.
No question.
The fact of the matter is, I think it is something you say there's something wrong with the wiring. I guess I would say, Andy, that there's something wrong with the water, because it happens to every individual in the modern era who enters that office.
With
the exception of Jimmy Carter, and it happened to him some too.
Well, yeah, you can make the case for it. He did a number on working class people too, because he's the one who really started the whole deregulation deal going, deregulating the airlines and deregulating the trucking industry. And you know, you bring up all the time what he did with mountaintop removal as well. I mean, he started that ball rolling too. He didn't do working class people.
Yeah, we'd have been far. I think we would have been far better off in the long run had he simply vetoed the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act.
Right.
But instead he signed it into law saying he thought it was a really, really big mistake.
But there's no question. There's something wrong. What is it?
Well, can
power
I...
Corrupts,
well, I mean, this
power
is...
Power corrupts that, absolutely.
It's,
Lord,
it's, yeah, it's Lord... It's
that?
Lord.
And
it's
just what's happened.
It's Lord Acton, you know.
Right.
But it's also...
Corrupted, absolutely.
But it is also the nature of the system that is in place in this current iteration of the so-called American experiment, Andy.
It's
the whole thing is rotten.
Executive. the power has just gone to these guys' heads, and it's gone overboard.
Well,
yeah,
and, well look, exactly.
Too,
you know,
Bradley Manning. He said Bradley Manning was guilty. He's guilty, man.
Back during the George W. Bush
one he said. I mean, it's unbelievable what comes out of his mouth.
Back during the George W. Bush administration, Andy, when those legal geniuses like John Yoo, who should be, you know, in a prison somewhere, were blathering on about, remember the unitary executive?
Right.
We haven't heard so much about that since George left. But the fact of the matter is, I was, you know, to the extent that a 5,000 watt signal can be said to be, you know, standing on the rooftop screaming, I kept asking all these little right wingers, these loyal Bushies, these George can do no wrong types, okay, you love the unitary executive. What are you going to think when the power of the unitary executive is in the hands of a Democrat, say a Hillary Clinton, because back then we weren't thinking Barack Obama. And I couldn't, you know, and they wouldn't face up to it. They wouldn't address it. Well, the unitary executive is, that concept is now in the hands of Barack Obama. And you've got, and the paranoids are going out of their tiny minds.
Right, he's taking advantage of it to the fullest extent because these are the powers he was given.
And within the scope of American history, that is what happens to presidents. Now, you've got, prior to his entry into the White House, you've got Thomas Jefferson fulminating against a federal government that has too much power, blah, 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 blah. He becomes president, and what's the first thing he does, or nearly the first thing he does? He engages in the single most overreaching act of the presidency thus far in engaging in the Louisiana Purchase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Adams did it, too, with the Alien and Sedition Act. You know the same man who defended the British soldiers in the Boston Massacre and got them off because of his love of liberty and freedom and his distaste for tyranny, you know, all of that.
John Adams
becomes president of the United States and immediately tries to clamp down on free speech.
Right.
It happens to every single individual who enters the White House. Now, there are periods in American history and that can be basically said to be that Democrats try to maintain the status quo of the presidency, whereas Republicans always try to expand the power of the presidency. That's no longer the case, Andy. Every president tries to expand the power of the presidency. And they're doing a damned fine job of it. And every expansion that has been engaged in under Barack Obama is going to seem like anathema to progressives and liberals and what have you the next time we've got a Republican president. And anybody who thinks there's not going to be another Republican president is not playing in the same reality world that I go swimming in.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I agree with you. No problem. It would just be nice if we had somebody like a Henry Wallace in there, or somebody on our side of the fence, like a Hugo Chavez, who is actually using those unrestricted, totally out of hand powers for the benefit of poor people in the working class and the planet. But we don't have that. Where the right wing does get somebody like a Bush in there, who criticism means nothing. You know, he just does for his class and for his people that got him in there. He goes, you know, to the wall. Whereas we just don't get that. But anyway.
You mentioned Henry Wallace.
It has to be reined in.
You mentioned Henry Wallace. Consider the fact that Henry Wallace had to be gotten rid of.
Well, they thought he was a communist, for God's sake.
Because, so we would have had President Wallace in 1945, but instead we got President Truman.
Right. And it
because Harry Truman,
totally different world.
Yeah, Harry Truman was a lackluster, no real reputation Missouri senator that the Democratic machine under FDR felt quite certain that they could control.
He was one of the good old boys.
Well, here's the news flash with that. Once you get once everybody starts calling you Mr. President, nobody controls you.
Right.
Unless you wish to be controlled. unless you, you know, nobody, if you're the president, Andy, nobody can make you go golfing with oil and pipeline executives. You have to want to do that.
No question. No question. But look at Dim Leader. I mean, there was an individual that could be in control. He was on Dick Cheney's leash. Dick Cheney and probably some other oligarchs.
Yeah, I probably overstated that a little bit.
He was too. He didn't have the intelligence level to make the decisions himself. That wasn't.
Yeah, but he's a great painter.
Yeah. Oh God, that was sick.
Yeah. See, Sandra kicking in here. She's right. She says Alexander Hamilton wanted an energetic executive, and the presidency has been flawed from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another authoritarian.
You know, that's why I think the show with Dr. Bill is going to be so engaging, because it's going to be an opportunity to spend two or three, you know, if it expands to 3 hours, that's cool. But at least 2 hours a day, 3 days a week, we're going to have an opportunity to look at the grand scheme of American governance and figure out what went wrong when, and how to fix it. Or if it can be fixed.
We need something done at the executive level. We really need the Congress to take more control and more power. I could take their power back that they were supposed to have.
Well, consider the remarks of Robert Byrd since this is the 10th anniversary and everything, consider the remarks of Robert Byrd in the run-up to the Iraq War. You know, he sat there and he wasn't even, if a lot of people think that he had come to some sort of anti-war stance. That is not what the speech is. The speech is a matter of begging the Congress to be the Congress that is set forth within the parameters of the Constitution. He had misgivings about the Iraq War. But the greatest misgiving that Robert Byrd had back in late 2002 and early 2003 was the fact that Congress was simply abdicating, and he used that word, abdicating its constitutional duties and responsibilities and powers.
Supine. They just rolled over on their backs, right? And they gave the War Powers Act. They just let that boy in the White House rip. Whatever he wanted to do.
I mean, if the Congress wanted to...
Terror was everywhere. Under every rock, there's a terrorist.
Right, but if the Congress wanted to declare war on Iraq, nobody could have stopped them.
Right, there's no domain that's not inhabited by a terrorist. Did you write? But they didn't. And look at Nancy Pelosi. You know, I'm no fan of the Democrats, man. I mean, I was just at a town hall meeting. We're trying to get a Disclose Act year out, for instance, and we had the Congresswoman Eshoo there at the meeting. I'm the only one. There must have been 100-150 people there. When she got up and talked, everybody's clapping. I had my thumbs down, because this is absurd. We can't even, in the legislature in California, we can't even pass an act with a supermajority, because some Democrats are going to hold it up just to understand where campaign funding is coming from. We can't even do that with Democrats. And here you had Nancy Pelosi as well. In 2008, we gave the Democrats a majority. We went to work and banged out a Congress with a vast Democratic majority to get rid of George Bush. And what's the first thing she does? It's off the table.
It's off the table.
Impeachment's off the table. You son of, you oligarch yourself, you rich. Nancy Pelosi, go to hell, Nancy. Go to hell. And these Democrats,
well, that's her, you know, and that's the thing. That's her legacy. Impeachment
go
is off the table
hell,
is her legacy. And no individual member of the legislative branch of the government of the United States should ever have the power to say that.
Right. And at this meeting I was at for the Disclose Act, I wanted to ask. I didn't get an opportunity. There were so many people that wanted to ask. I wanted to ask, okay, we have a Democratic supermajority in Sacramento. Who are the Democrats that aren't going to pass it? Those are who we work on. We know you guys here. We had some good legislators there. I can name who they are if you want, but no big deal. Probably most of the group wouldn't understand who they are. But they were good. They were good Democrats. We knew they would be for it because they were there at this big kickoff rally. But there's going to be a few Democrats, so I want to know who they are. Who are the Democrats that aren't going to go along with this no-brainer bill just to disclose where all the damn money is coming from? And you know, I didn't get an opportunity to ask that question, but I knew if I even asked it, I would have got crickets, but it would have been a pretty good comedy just to watch the crickets happen. But who are the Democrats that are holding this up? Because they tried to do this the last session, and they couldn't get it through. Couldn't get it, and they need a supermajority vote to have it happen.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's not even so much, I guess the first question is, who are the Democrats who are holding it up? But once you've got the answer to that, then you get the real answer, because you get their donor lists, and you find out who's really holding it up. And, you know, come on, Andy, it's the usual suspects, isn't it?
Right.
It's who?
It'll be Chevron.
Oil companies, defense contractors, power utilities.
Right. Where it's usually Chevron is basically owns the state. You got General Dynamics, also huge, owning the state. PG&E, just like you said, the people that like to blow up their customers.
And maybe you might find out some things that you really didn't wanted to know, but you didn't expect to know. You might find out, for instance, that some of the folks that were behind the "no, come on, let's keep on feeding unknown crap to Californians," paid some of these folks for the, you know, not getting real enthusiastic about Prop 37, for instance.
Right, smoking them out. At least that's what it does. You smoke out who they are. Same thing, we can't get a single payer bill. You know, we were so enthralled that now we got a super majority, we can get super payer done. Well, we can't get a Democrat to sponsor the bill. It's done. It's over. No.
But
Democrat
that's the thing about being a Democrat. I don't want to be tired and trite or anything, but what Will Rogers said is very true. I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
And when I took one of the legislators to task over the weekend, I cornered him, and I showed him what the rate hikes were that Aetna, Blue Cross, and Blue Shield wanted, like 36%, 26%, and then 20% rate hikes they were looking for. I go, this Affordable Health Care Act, man, isn't cutting it. Look what they're doing. We need single payer. You know, I don't care what happened, we still need single payer. This is the only solution. And I asked, why isn't this happening? And he goes, it's the leadership, Andy. It's the leadership. They do not want it in any terms.
Yeah, so go and look them up and find out how many of them have taken substantial donations from Kaiser Permanente, United.
That's who I was going to say. Kaiser Permanente has already been singled out as one of the big contributors to the Democrats. You got Aetna, Blue Cross, Blue Shield. They're the ones. They have them in the, they have the Democrats in their back pocket. Never ends. Can't win. You know, something else you brought up last week, too, and I didn't respond in an email. Sybil Edmonds. People
yeah.
have to understand, she's a libertarian in a lot of her views. I listen to her quite a bit. She does a Boiling Frogs podcast piece.
Yeah.
She really does, in a lot of ways, side with the Paul father and son pair. So that shouldn't be any surprise to anybody. Where she stands. I know one of your callers indicated that they were surprised Sybil Edmonds was making some pause. Maybe she tweeted, or I don't know what she did, but if you know Sybil Edmonds, that's not a surprise. That's her political philosophy. She's very much a liberal.
Yeah, and you know what? People can be what they want to be, Andy, but my concern is when we start getting pretending that people are who they aren't. You know, the biggest... For instance, to go back to Barack Obama, I think a lot of, you know, seriously progressive people get really, really frustrated and angry with Barack Obama because we've spent 6 years now, you know, counting the campaign and campaigns and everything. We've spent 6 years projecting our hopes, our ambitions, our dreams, our beliefs onto him. And expecting him to be that. He isn't that.
Don't generalize, Bob.
He is
a lot of people caught on to him.
Early. He isn't that and never has been, though.
But the problem is, he lied. He lied. He led people on. I can send you a video that shows he's a single-payer guy.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
I can show you that video.
You mean from the Illinois legislature?
No, when he was running for president. He was single payer. Then he ratcheted down to be public option. It's out there. You can find it. He misled people. That's the problem with him. That's one thing I'll give the Paul boys, the father and son. At least you know where those bastards are coming from. You know that those guys are crazy. Both Ron and Rand. Those guys are nuts. And the Lochner thing you brought up is spot on. These guys do not get it. That you, some people have power in this country, and some people need the government to help them, to lift them up. And they will never get that. That there's a negotiating imbalance between the working class and the employer. They will never figure that out. But Obama, at least you know where they're coming from. They're both nuts. They're crazy people. Their views are just totally irrational. But Obama, you don't know where he's coming from because he misled people. He's a liar. That's the difference between.
See, I
know
see him
where
as
the polls are coming from. You do not know where Obama is coming from.
I see Barack Obama as a straight up corporatist, so I kind of figure I do know where he's coming from.
Well, you got it.
This country is
whatever he says. Remember, he's a straight up corporatist, and he's also turning into a pretty good warmonger too.
You know, I was just thinking. I'm glad you mentioned that because
justice
I was just thinking.
Justice doesn't mean too much to that dude. You know,
I was just thinking.
I was law. Going before your peers, I don't think that registers with him either anymore.
I was just thinking earlier today, you've seen the news about the saber rattling coming out of North Korea, right?
Yeah.
Now, he's not going to start a war with North Korea. But wouldn't it just be wonderful for him if they'd start shooting first? I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful for any president if somebody would start shit with us?
It always, North Korea always amazes me, because here's a country with a GDP smaller than Rhode Island, for God's sakes. It's just a total joke. These guys, just it's the barking dog, you know, with no bite. And all you got to do is throw some food at them or some kind of aid, and then they'll shut up for a while, and until they want something else. They'll open their traps again. But you got this fool Rice at the UN coming down, stirring up things, you know, putting more, you know, stringent, I don't know what she's doing, some kind of blockade or some kind of, you know, tax so people don't trade with North Korea. I mean, come on. Please. You know, coming down on them. And this is how they react. When we do that. And here you got a country, you know, like I said, it's got a GDP of less than Rhode Island. What the heck? If the South Koreans aren't upset over what's going on over there, you know, why should we? Except it's an absurd situation.
Yeah, it is. It is, you know, those of us of a certain age may remember a famous script made into a movie called The Mouse That Roared.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory of the mouse that roared is that a wee tiny country invades the United States because the only way, the best way to get yourself raised up in this world is to lose to the United States, their goal being to invade and then immediately surrender, and you lose to the United States, and then the United States rebuilds you into a wonderful nation with, you know, lots of great stuff. I look at the North Korea stuff, which is deadly serious, especially if you're south of the 38th parallel, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is the script to the mouse that roared.
Right.
And, I mean, there's so many dynamics going on there. You know, you've got a 29-year-old deer leader who has to, the old generals have to make sure that he understands that he's in charge because they're in charge. And as a result of that, you've got this saber rattling and this you know, warmongering. And if they so much, you know, the North Korean military declared the truce is over, that's pretty serious business. I mean, previous dear leaders didn't do that. So
I guess they had to figure out something dramatic to do.
Well, yeah, and we'll send them food.
The counter is rice in the UN. You know, getting the UN.
Meanwhile, I saw today that
to a clamp down on.
I saw earlier today that John Hornstache Bolton is out there screaming from the to the rafters that the Israel's got to attack Iran right now because America doesn't have the guts to do it.
There's another suspect of a brain dead individual. You know, just the Night of the Mummies. Whatever,
yeah.
The Night of the Living Dead. Guy, that guy is just totally out of it.
Oh,
he's a warmonger. That's his middle name.
You know, and that you know, we're still waiting for that whole dirty that whole dirty generation to just go away. The John Negroponte, for God's sakes. The man who cut his teeth on death squads in El Salvador.
Right.
And still,
Bob, they're always with us. These people are always going to be with us. The thing is, though, they used to be marginalized. Now they're mainstream because of the press we have and the media we have. But they used to be marginalized. Now they're not. And it's a shame. Because definitely guys like Bolton do us no good. You know, they should be comical. They should be off in a corner somewhere, you know, playing with building blocks. But instead, they get mainstream pickup by the corporate media. It's criminal. Because they're nuts. They're just totally nuts. And one other thing that's got my craw before I get out of here, I don't want to take too much time.
No, you're doing fine.
Thanks. Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook, I don't know if many people know her. She just came out with a book, and she's getting a lot of press because of it. Your front page, newspapers, and so forth. People should understand that Facebook, do you know that they had a fundraiser for governor? Guess who?
Not again, please.
Of
I can't.
New Jersey.
Christie.
Yeah. Like 2 weeks ago, they did a major fundraiser for Chris Christie at the Facebook headquarters.
Jesus.
This is the type of company that is.
Oh, look. Well, I mean, it's not on the same level, Andy, but I've got another one out there. There was a post up at Think Progress. And they're really good with their fact story reporting, but their opinion stuff has begun to really be disturbing to me. But they had this post up, an opinion piece about why we need a healthy Republican Party. And you know, there I was, kicking furniture and looking for liquor bottles again. Because, you know, can we let the let them tear themselves to pieces, let them fall apart, let them slide into obscurity, let them do whatever they're going to do. But let's not worry about whether the Republican Party is healthy or not until we get a healthy Democratic Party. And I think the sum and substance of this conversation that we've had for the last few minutes, Andy, is it points toward the down the road that says the Democratic Party is not healthy right now. It's not.
The executives at Facebook who love H-1B visa people, too, they're American workers over there. People have to understand, when you use Facebook, you are giving money and your personal information to a company that hates Americans and hates American workers. People have to understand that. This is a company that wants foreign workers to take Americans' jobs. I don't care if it's done at a low level, at a McDonald's, like it is brought up by Rick Smith, who comes on after you, or
yeah.
Done at a Hershey's. Silicon Valley is an awful, awful place when it comes to helping out the American worker. They don't care. That H-1Bs are fine to take jobs, and Facebook is numero uno in making sure no matter how much unemployment we have, how many Americans are qualified and out of work, they still will grab for those H-1Bs. And Cory Booker is another name that you put. They want people like Cory Booker and Chris Christie, because they know they can count on a Cory Booker to work with Chris Christie. That's who the executives want. They want people in politics that they can buy. Because Cory Booker is another one of these folks that Mark Zuckerberg just loves. He loves Cory Booker. They want to see Cory Booker get ahead. You know, he wants to be senator instead of Rottenberg when he drops out of New Jersey anyway.
Right.
That's where these executives are coming from. You know, that is where they're at.
Oh, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And the fact of the matter is, at what level? Yeah, no, Cory Booker wants to replace Lautenberg. Okay, where's the really progressive future candidate?
There's not.
Right, and so that goes, you know, that goes back to what I said a couple minutes ago.
Fundraisers for people like that. Yeah.
You've got Democratic think tanks out there that are making arguments about why we need a healthy Republican Party when we can't even consistently put progressive Democrats.
They want progressive
on the ballot.
Democrats.
No, they don't want it.
They don't. The working people want progressive Democrats. People like me, but party doesn't. They want corporate.
I mean, look at what and I'm not trying to make this all about me, Andy, but look at what I'm facing. Okay? Jay Rockefeller, who has never been somebody I would refer to as, you know, a Bernie Sanders type. I mean, he's had his sort of little bit liberal moments, but he's no hardcore liberal within any sense of the word. I mean, the man doesn't like to criticize the coal industry. Well, he's quitting in 2014. And it is almost a lead pipe cinch that this poor, beaten, bedraggled, worn out, broke down, busted up state is going to send either the daughter of the single most crooked governor West Virginia has ever known, maybe we'll send that lunatic, the guy who thinks that not being able to smoke in his office building is the same as being sent to Auschwitz, John Racy, to the Senate. Because there's really no progressive in this state that used to be one of the most unionized states in the United States. There is no real progressive who can step into that struggle.
Right. The power elite in the Democratic Party does everything they can to crush progressive thought before it can get started. They will try their best to crush you. They do not. It goes again to Carlin's comment. It's a big club, man.
And we ain't in it.
Part of it. We're not part. We got to make our own club and take over this club. And it's what I try to tell some of your callers. They don't want you in it, man. They do not want you. Got to fight for everything you get. And you got to stick with guys like Kucinich, because they got targets on their back. That's why he's out. They don't want him mucking things up, like doing an impeachment papers. No. You don't do that. No matter how much of a murderer, killer, you break the Constitution in two, you know, you crap on it, it don't matter, because they're in power, and that's all that matters, is them being in power. All that matters.
Yeah. By the way, you got a little fan mail from Jack down in Shreveport. He said, regarding H-1Bs, I am so on board with what's being said about the H-1B visas. No matter how much unemployment we have among tech people in this country, the high-tech companies want more and more H-1B visas approved.
Doesn't matter.
To bring in more people from out of the country to drive down wages.
Right. Absolutely. How can you justify H-1B when the median income keeps going down? And for tech workers, how can you justify that? If there was any kind of demand for workers, Jesus, the wages would be going up, but they're not. They're going down. There's no justification for H-1Bs. There's none. We've got plenty of well-qualified work, especially college students coming out with computer science and electrical engineering degrees. God damn, give them a start. You don't bring in foreign workers to take that. It's absurd. It's an absurd argument. Absurd. And when you unemployment in this state, how can you keep pushing for H-1Bs? Again, absurd. Totally absurd.
And I think that all sort of wraps up into what Sandra has called the new normal. does it yeah. not?
Well, it's again, it's who has the power.
I mean, when you come right down to it, when the Democrats and the Republicans both really want something, this meme of gridlock, man, it goes away like fog burning up in summer sun.
Right. And a perfect example of this is what you brought up last week and with Sandra about DOMA. And I sent you an article
that
showed, hey, now you have 100 corporations signing an amicus brief to make sure DOMA goes down, that we get rid of it. And it's de rigueur now. It's okay with corporate America. So both parties have no reason not to back it. And Olson on one side.
Right, and you know, there's a learning curve there, Andy, and I think it's really, really important. You know, it's not what the people want in this country anymore. What determines the social progress that we make or the cultural progress we make is when the companies, when the corporations get on board.
Right. 100 corporations are now behind it. You don't have one even against it, even though there were some southern corporations they mentioned in that article that were upset that they'd mouth off a little, but they're not going to do an amicus brief against it.
No, but for instance,
overwhelmingly okay. Now.
On the day that American business figures out that it is manifestly to their interest to have universal single-payer health care, on that day, Andy, we'll have universal single-payer health care. Now, what amazes me is why it's...
You got that right, man.
Is why they, have, why they
no
haven't come...
Greater.
I never understood why the American auto companies, who are the best example.
Because they're taking care of their own, Bob. And there's another issue, too, where a lot of companies have their own in-house health insurance. They actually make money on the insurance that they
own. Well, that would make sense, because it seems to me that when 30% of a car's sticker price consists of for-profit health care provision, then if you had the government doing it, that's 30% that comes off the sticker, and you're a hell of a lot more competitive with Japanese and German automobiles.
And Canada.
Yeah.
And you'd think so, wouldn't you? I mean, that would be a no-brainer. The whole thing.
But instead, from a
societal standpoint with single payer and an economic standpoint, as you just laid out, it's totally a no-brainer way to go. But I think a lot of it is, number one, you have to look into some of these companies are actually making money because they provide their own in-house insurance, and there might be some kickbacks going on between the corporations and the insurance companies where they get a piece of the action as well. So, and it's just a chamber of commerce thing where there's something in business where everybody scratches each other's back. You know, you work with me here, I'll work with you there. And it's hard to bust that.
Well, and there's also
at the oligarch level.
There's two different ways to look at the healthcare industry or the healthcare problem. If you're a car manufacturer, for instance, on the one hand, you can say it would be American car makers could say it would be better for us if the United States had universal single payer health care, because then we'd be competing on the same on a level playing field with Japan, Canada, and Germany. Or you can do what the Japanese, Canadian, and German auto manufacturers have done and said, wait a minute, you've got practically a captive population in the American South, so why don't we go to the American South where we're not going to have to pay some some union scale, we're not going to have to pay for health care, and they'll be thrilled if we pay them to make our Kias and our Hyundais and our Passats for $12 an hour, and they'll feel like they're lucky to have the job because, hey, those people don't have the guts to stand up on their own hind legs and actually demand that we do something for them.
Right.
You know, by the way, Sandra just tweeted in and said, no political cover is why Obama can't get the grand bargain done. As soon as that's sorted out, the safety net is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's the thing. There's still a handful of Democrats in the House and the Senate who will not go along with tearing down the social safety net.
No question. I'm convinced he wants to do it. It keeps coming out. He's got this Gene Sperling in there. He's got Jack Lew. These guys are the Concord group, man. They're Robert Rubinites. They have no problem cutting that safety net. Just selling the working class people to the dogs, man.
Right down the river.
Those two. Right. No problem. Hey, just real quick, one other thing that caught my eye, which I thought is, you know, I talk about the Czech Republic quite a bit, and they just elected a president recently, and they've had this dude that was in as president. He's called a civic democrat, which is a right of center, more conservative point of view. Václav Klaus, right? He's getting termed out of office because they just did the elections for the first time, and they're getting a social democrat in, which is a more left of center, which is a good thing. This guy, Zeman. Anyway, guess where Václav Klaus is going to work now?
You're going to J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs,
Cato Institute.
Oh, gee.
In the Czech Republic, they have the Cato Institute, and the guy is known. He's an economist. He's very libertarian. As a matter of fact, he's totally against climate change. Climate change does not exist. Totally pro-nuke. Totally against a safety net. He always has. He's a libertarian. They've had a libertarian in as a president for the Czech Republic for like 10 years now. He's going to the Cato Institute. These guys, these think tanks of the oligarchs are all over the world. Don't think you can get away with that. You know, like one of the guys on your show, I forget, is it another Kevin or something like that, moving out of the country?
Yeah, Kevin.
You can't get away from this, man.
No.
They're all over Europe. They're all over. The right wing is doing everything. They're doing the cookie cutter that worked in the United States with these think tanks all over.
Well, the European austerity craze was not something the Europeans came up with, Andy.
Sure.
That was cooked up right here in the good old U.S. of A. and exported.
Right. And if people don't understand it, Obama has been doing the austerity program. They just don't say it. But when you cut, I think a million government workers have been cut since the recession started. I think over 700,000 under Obama, and we keep dropping government workers out of Obama's. And this is unprecedented. Unprecedented during a recessionary time, McKinsey and economics, and especially a so-called, in quotes, Democrat, which I don't consider Mr. Obama a Democrat. But people can question me on that. But I'm so done with this guy. I'm just done, you know. I've been done for a long time, as you probably know. But yeah, Cato Institute.
I read something the other day talking about how the Cato Institute, the creation of the Cato Institute, was a direct result of the Powell memo.
Right, I believe the guys that originally bankrolled it were the Coors.
But I mean, all, you know, the Scaifes and the Cokes,
right,
and the Coors, you know, they all lined up. And, man, they gave... I mean, I got to give credit where credit's due, Andy. They gave till it hurt.
Right. They plan. They plan ahead. They figure out a strategy, and then they execute. And they put their money where their mouth is, like you said, unlike the people on our side, which can't seem to get their act together. And they know that the media is so important, that owning the media, owning the message, getting that word out, the echo chamber, over and over, repeat,
right,
over and over. They understand that.
Right. Meanwhile, on our side, we don't seem to have anybody based on
the messaging
who understands messaging.
Right.
Because it's not
Lakoff screams and hollers, tries to get it across. This is not how you do not say the word entitlement. You do not use Obamacare. You should never. And what does Obama do? First thing out of his goddamn trap will be he will re-echo chamber the Republican talking point, and he does it time and time again.
And you know, I say this not because, not, I mean, you know, here we are. Yeah, I'm proud of the fact that we've been alive for 10 years. But yeah, here we are, and we literally struggle from month to month. But it's not just us, Andy. You know, Sam Cedar struggles, Malloy struggles, Rick Smith struggles. Everybody struggles. You know, even if you're picked up by the group that carries most of the progressive terrestrial radio dial, you know, it's a struggle. It is a constant struggle. Stephanie struggles. Hartman struggles. Even Ed Schultz struggles. Because our side does not understand it. Hey, before we ring off, I want to share with you a note, and it's got some fun F words in it. I'm just going to read them. This came from Michael because of your revelation about Code Pink and the chocolates.
Box of chocolates.
Yeah, with the subject line "Jesus fucking Christ." Michael writes, "Does Code Pink not give a shit about Violence Against Women Act? Because with all due respect to the seriousness of the drone issue, when we're talking American soil, on foreign soil, I don't give a fuck if it's drones or Marines, I think we should just fucking stop. But on American soil, I'm a little more fucking concerned that a woman will get beat, raped, or killed by a spouse or partner than I am about getting zapped by a fucking drone. And let's not forget what Randy Paul said about MTR while we're on the subject, not to mention the Civil Rights Act. Fuck Rand Paul. I hope he chokes on the chocolates."
I love it. I knew that was... That's why I started off when I called. I knew you would...
You're
the listeners at the horn. I knew you would...
You're a daggum...
Rattled over that.
Yeah, you're...
It's true. They sent a box of chocolate.
No, they didn't send them. They carried them. I looked it up. I thought you were kidding at first.
No.
No, they carried them. They hand-carried
them. I'm sure they...
They hand...
They probably blew them.
And here's the fun part. For a group of women who are into peace and feminism and all of that stuff, you know why they said the chocolates they brought him, you know what they were? They were the Ferrero Rocher, you know, hazelnut round things.
Yeah.
And
good Austrian stuff.
And so here's what the report says. Code Pink members...
Belgian. They're not Belgian chocolates, are they?
I hope the hell not.
Really get you...
Code Pink member Medea Benjamin said the chocolates were chosen as a gift because of their ball-like shape. "He's got them," she said of the senator. So we worked in a little sexism with it too. Good job, Code Pink.
Roses?
Good job.
What about the roses? They talk about the. I thought they brought him some roses too. I believe to top it off.
Oh yeah, there were flowers and Ferrero Rocher.
There you go.
Now, see, you know that Randy Paul Goat Boy did not eat the chocolates because, you know, it might turn him queer or something. You know, because, yeah, he's Randy Paul, masculine libertarian ophthalmologist.
I'd bring him down to the Senate floor and give him out to the Democrats.
Well, there you go.
Well, I enjoyed the dialogue you had last week anyway, but, you know, even though... We don't totally agree, as you know, but you have a great opinion. Always welcome, man.
Thank you, Andy. You have a good night.
Always welcome. All right, you take care of yourself.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, and by the way, I did mention, a different Randy. Thank you to Randy for helping us out with the fundraising this evening, because it is all that has happened. So here with 7 minutes to go in the program, 6 minutes to go in the program, we find ourselves $120 behind in fundraising for the night. But anyway, on to the last call of the evening. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's your Marine Corps buddy, Mark.
Hey, Mark, what's happening?
Hey, was that Andy or Randy, the last caller?
That was Andy.
Andy, you got to love that guy. He's got some deep convictions. And, Andy, I hope you're still listening. And I always love listening to his perspectives. Just to chime in with the conversation, I'm wondering if Rand Paul didn't get those chocolates and flowers because he's about the same size as Media Benjamin might be in stature, about the same amount of masculinity exists in both individuals. But and I'm all for people being able to marry whoever they want. That wasn't what that comes.
No, I got it. No.
Yeah, he's not a very masculine man as far as men are concerned, but. I know we only got a couple seconds, Bob, and I just wanted to say either President Obama is doing a giant rope-a-dope. I see that North Korea, I don't think that that situation there, I don't know how real that is or how make-believe it is. I don't think it's to be ignored. Obviously, it's not. The Americans are there on an operation with the South Koreans. And then you look at the AIPAC as really putting the screws to, Americans trying to get the war in Iran going. So it either President Obama is a giant Muhammad Ali with a rope-a-dope and is getting ready to make some real progress, or we have what I think your observations are, somebody that's actually quite conservative with his approaches to things, with who speaks one language and executes another. I'm going to continue to give President Obama all the leeway he needs to the day his term is up, and I just hope for the best. And that's all I could say. And I would also say to Andy, in defense of Tiger Woods, his father did, I think, probably at least 3 tours in Vietnam, unfortunately, and did them quite bravely. And that doesn't make Tiger anything in particular, but I know he loved his father, and I think the loss of his father is why his wheels kind of spun off. And actually, how ironic it is that Tiger roars back after meeting with the president. I'm not an apologist. But I'm not an ignorant optimist, but being a veteran, I still give my commanding officer, who is our president, and not our commanding officer, but our president, I give him all the opportunity to do the right thing to the very last minute. And I see that all this pressure coming from different directions right now could be because he has made and is about to make a lot more progress, but maybe not. And if that's not the case, then we'll address it in 16. But anyway, Bob, I just want to let you know I'm always listening, and I'm not criticizing anyone. And I love the gentleman from Ohio. Is that Bill?
Yeah, that's Bill.
Bill, I think I just love listening to his stories. He sews everything up. I'll just hang up, Bob, and let you close out your show. I appreciate you fielding my call.
Oh, no worries. No worries, Mark. It's always good to hear from you, my friend.
Yeah, I know you've been working hard, Bob, and man, the environment, and it's the subject of topics everywhere you look. I mean, all kinds of commercial interests and international. Even though it didn't get approached by the president or the administration in the election for the first time in 30 or 40 years, but it seems like it's the most talked about subject. Even though it's not an official thing, even though it kind of is with the State Department's involvement and other issues, but you're making progress, Bob. However we measure it, I hope
we are. We had somewhere on a mountaintop removal site not far from here, we had a blast go off right at 5 p.m. And it's not exactly like hearing artillery fire, but it's close enough to give me the willies.
I understand, and let's hope that was just a coincidence. All right, Bob, have a good night.
All right, take care, Mark. Bye.
Semper Fi.
Our buddy Mark, calling from Florida. And that brings us to the end of this Morin Monday. Thomas Friedman, Jesus. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for keeping this all going as long and as much as you have. And hopefully we'll just keep it rolling. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. A reminder, join us for Dr. Bill O'Brien and the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, again tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Dr. Bill files will be going into my Dropbox until we've gotten that set up. And if you want to join into the Dropbox, just shoot me an email and I'll send you an invitation. And thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.